This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Hear about the numerous attempts over the decades to make a West Bloomington grocery store a reality.
It's a complicated formula to find the right grocery store chain to come in on the right location.
Deb Halperin of the West Bloomington Revitalization Project, GLT, continues its reporting on food deserts. You'll also hear from Bloomington Economic Development Coordinator Austin Grammer about efforts to establish a supermarket on Bloomington's west side. And it's a conversation with members of the Brazilian Airs. The Latin band joins with an orchestra for a special Valentine's Day concert. All of that and a GLT news update on the way. It's February 8th, 2018. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. There are 10 large supermarkets, all in a row, on the east side of Bloomington and Normal. But the west side remains what the U.S. Department of Agriculture describes as a food desert, an area where people have to travel a mile or more to get to a supermarket. Instead, the west side is a fast food haven. Some small grocery stores have tried to make a go of it on the west side, only to close. Community activists have been asking for a large chain to come in, but none seems willing. Why is it so difficult, and what is the human cost of not having access to fresh produce and other healthy foods? Deborah Halperin is a West Bloomington Revitalization Project board member. She oversees the Veggie Oasis, a program that collects fresh produce and other items from the farmers market and supermarket chains to give away to those in need. She tells GLT's Judy Valente that poor people often end up paying more for less healthy food.
You're definitely spending more money for the convenience of buying those items at a convenience store, but they're incredibly limited healthy options there, which is an additional burden on low-income families that are often facing other health challenges. You know, if you have diabetes or if you have heart trouble, you don't want to be eating your meals sourced from a convenience store. You have to really pay attention to the food that you're putting in your body. And if you can't get to a grocery store to make better selections, you're really limited. And it exacerbates, I think, ongoing health trouble that we can see in families.
There are many, many supermarkets in Bloomington Normal. They're just not in areas where poor people live, by and large.
Right.
What is the reason for that? Why can't we get a supermarket, say, in West Bloomington?
We have been trying to get a supermarket on the west side because it's what our residents tell us they want the most. When we say, you know, what would make your neighborhood a better place? They say, you know, we would really love to have a more convenient grocery store. Well, there are a couple of challenges with that. One is that our understanding is to have a successful grocery store, you need to have people that are able to shop there and spend enough money because the margin of profit in a grocery store is very small. So it is tough to recruit a business with a low profitability margin to an area that's low income, where just by the demographics alone, you know that people don't have a lot of extra money to spend. The other challenge is finding the property that you could make available for the footprint needed for a grocery store. If they need enough space for the store itself and all the parking close to a high traffic street, you know, it's an old part of town. And so can we hold the building and all that it would require, and what would need to make way in order for that, you know, building to come in? It's a tricky grid to try and put something with a big footprint into.
Do you think that city officials could step in? I mean, they floated bonds when they wanted an athletic center like the Coliseum. They have been willing to give tax breaks to hotels to come in. The town of Normal is willing to give a tax break for a shopping center to be built. Is there nothing that the cities, Normal and Bloomington, can do to help this situation in the poorer neighborhoods?
That's a good question. I think the WBRP has been fortunate to have both Scott Black and Karen Schmidt on our board of directors. So we have a really great partnership with the city. I just think it's a complicated formula to find the right grocery store chain, maybe to come in on the right location so that they're successful and it's the right fit for the neighborhood. And that the families we work with on the west side mostly shop at the Walmart. That there's a bus line that will take them out there. That's where they do most of their shopping. Some of them shop at the Kroger on Main. So I think our families are just looking for how far can I stretch my grocery dollar? And it's a matter of, you know, looking for sales. Where can I get to this week? How much money do I have left in SNAP benefit? Can I get to other food banks or food pantries? I think juggling that food budget is an ongoing battle for a lot of the families we work with.
Yeah, what you're talking about is that there is, it's a constant struggle to figure out if you're going to be able to feed your family week to week.
Oh, absolutely, which breaks my heart, really. I just can't believe that in a community of plenty that we have families that are really struggling with hunger. And it's true. So the trick of, you know, after I pay my rent and after I pay my bills, how much money do I have left for my family to eat? If my kids are maybe eating at school for breakfast, maybe lunch, can I cover dinner? Can I get to these different food pantries during the time that they are open and available? Can I get shelf-stable canned goods from this place and so I can spend my money on the fresh produce that I need? It is really hard, I think, and an ongoing and growing challenge for families to buy everything they want to buy to feed their family. And, you know, and I think that's when people start making choices of, well, I have to work late, so I can only stop by a convenience store to pick up milk on my way home. And they end up having to choose to buy more expensive milk, even though they know they could get it cheaper elsewhere. But they're having to make a lot of sacrifices in terms of their time and if they have access to a car or if they can access to a bus or a bike. You know, there's a lot of choices that a family has to consider about how they get food to the table.
The weeks that I visited your veggie oasis, most of the people who come there are working.
Oh, absolutely.
They're the working poor.
They are absolutely the working poor. So they're working one job, one and a half jobs, two jobs, right? That everyone in the family is pitching in to try and get income to cover all the bills. And groceries are just one of them. But I think, you know, groceries are sometimes a flex category, right? That if I have to pay my car, I have to pay my insurance. If you're paying your car and your insurance, I have to pay rent, I have to pay utilities. Therefore, what's left for groceries? And it becomes a category of what's left. Instead of saying, you know, I wish this could be a higher budget priority for my family to feed everyone healthy meals and cook the meals I like to cook and like to eat. And I know my family should be eating, but it's an area where we're going to have to make sacrifices.
That brings me to another point, that it's almost a vicious cycle, because food that is bad for you is often the cheapest food that you can buy.
I know. So when you think about all the fast food places you would need to pass before you got to a grocery store, right, that you could go through any number of drive-thrus down Market Street before you hit the Walmart out on Market. It's really tempting, I think, for a busy family to go, okay, I'm going to go to Walmart. I'm going to buy fresh produce. I'm going to cook. I'm going to do the dishes. I'm going to pack the leftovers. I'm going to make, you know, healthy lunches. And then you think, oh, wow, look at that, you know, cheap value meal. I could get five things off of that for a lot less money. And I can't blame them for being tempted by that, of course.
The state legislature has proposed tracking food deserts now, mm-hmm. forcing the state agriculture department to study this and to report back to the legislature where these food deserts are. Will that help?
I hope it will. I also hope that we can come up with some creative ideas as a community that maybe until there's more long-term solutions to food deserts, that we can look at other communities in ways that maybe they've been successful in making sure that the families living in food deserts have greater access to fresh produce, or cooking classes, or meal delivery programs, or community-supported agriculture programs. Maybe there are other ways that while we're waiting for the legislature or for a budget or for us to move up the priority list, there are still plenty of things that I think we can do, and we have to be creative in coming up with some of those ideas. Some people think, well, just because you don't live next door to a grocery store, there's grocery stores all over, right? You could drive to any number of grocery stores of your choice. But I think another challenge for low-income families is that they don't have a car. And so, you know, they rely on a bus. Maybe the bus comes once an hour. And if you're hoping to buy a lot of fresh produce, will it last till the next time you can do that? Will it last until the next time your SNAP card is reloaded? So again, we see people choosing foods that are maybe frozen or canned. And there are some very good nutritional options there, but maybe it's not what you would buy if you had all the money you wanted in your grocery budget and a car to get you to the grocery store. I just think the low-income families that we work with and we meet through programs like Veggie Oasis are thinking about dinner in an entirely different way than families that have money and have access to cars.
Deborah Halperin is a board member of the West Bloomington Revitalization Project. She's also director of the Action Resource Center at Illinois Wesleyan. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm Judy Valente.
The Veggie Oasis that Deborah Halperin helps oversee offers free produce on Saturdays from June to October in front of the West Bloomington Revitalization Project building on West Washington Street. Beacon of Hope offers free food on Saturdays at the Revitalization Office throughout the winter. You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. In the 1970s, there were a number of small grocery stores sprinkled through the West Bloomington neighborhoods, as well as an IGA supermarket. By the 1980s, nearly all were gone. Some closed due to the normal course of business. Others could not compete when the West Side Walmart opened west of Interstate 55. For some 30 years, West Side residents have been asking for a full-service supermarket closer to their neighborhoods. Bloomington Economic Development Coordinator Austin Grammer says city officials have been trying for at least that long to convince one of the large supermarket chains to move into the area. Grammer tells GLT's Judy Valente city government has a role to play in the matter, but there are economic and infrastructure barriers to overcome.
I think the role the government can play in addressing a food desert is ensuring access to quality public transportation. And so in this case, we have Connect Transit that provides good service to the west side. Could it potentially be better? That's a question to help those that don't have the ability to afford a car ownership to be able to get to a grocery store. So I think that's one role that the government can play is in transportation. Another role is potentially partnering with private developers and these retailers when there is interest to potentially develop a full-line grocery store on the west side or in a particular neighborhood. There's many different ways that the municipality can form a public-private partnership with a developer and a retailer. In case in point is the city's partnership with Greentop Grocery and the developer of the Foundry.
In what ways would you see that kind of partnership playing out? What would it really entail? Would it entail giving them tax incentives as you've given to some other companies, some developers?
Yeah, municipalities across the nation, and I mean, I can think of a couple specific examples in Rockford and also in Decatur. The municipality partnered with developers to do new construction of Save-A-Lot grocery stores in lower income areas in Rockford and in Decatur. That took the form of tax increment financing, clearing of land, donation of land, sales tax rebates, those different types of things in order to help make those private projects financially feasible.
When we aired our story on West Bloomington as a food desert on Monday, we received an email from a gentleman who lives in Bloomington who said, "We've been talking about this since the 70s. And nothing has really happened. No grocery chain has moved in close in to the residential neighborhoods. Why has this taken so long? If there are possibilities,
Well, a lot of it comes into play with the demands of the retailers and their knowledge of what is going to be profitable for them. There were quite a number of grocery stores in the downtown area, on the fringe of the downtown, on the west side, that were more modest stores, 10 to 20,000 square feet. There was an IGA food liner where the Talcris plasma facility is, just to the west of downtown. There was at one time an Aldi store next to the Department of Motor Vehicles on West Market Street. So there have in the past been grocery stores in the area, but due to consumer demand for larger stores, bigger selection, more abundant parking, those retailers have unfortunately left this area and gone to greenfield sites where they can build those bigger stores and have those bigger parking lots.
The Bloomington resident who wrote to us made an interesting point that it's great to have the Walmart there, but in fact the Walmart may have driven some of the small grocers that were closer to the residential neighborhoods out of the area.
That's right. There was at one time, like I mentioned, an Aldi store in the Market Square shopping center on West Market Street next to the Department of Motor Vehicles and the Pilot truck stop. But then when the new Super Walmart was developed on the west side of the interstate, Aldi's business model said, well, if we shadow Walmart's, we will be successful. We should pick up and move and build next to the Walmart on the other side of the interstate. And unfortunately, that left the residents that, you know, depended upon that store in that general neighborhood with no option other than to go across the interstate to the Aldi store or the Walmart there.
On the east side of Bloomington and into parts of Normal, there's 10 large chain grocery stores in a row. Why does that make sense for all these stores to be in the same spot? You would think they'd all be competing with each other for the same customers.
I think it's really two parts. Again, it gets back to the retailer's desire to make a profit, and retailers are very risk adverse. And so they say, well, if I locate where everyone is going to be shopping, whether it's for groceries or other general merchandise, I'm more likely not going to fail. And then they can also tag team off of each other's marketing spending for advertising. So again, the retailers want to avoid risk. It also gets back to sort of a general land use planning in that we have created zoning and development of that land along Veterans Parkway to cater to the big box retailers, and that's where that space is available for those types of retailers to locate.
I'm glad you mentioned land use, because one of the reasons retailers and even some of our city council members say there is not a large chain grocery store in that area of town is that there's no space for it. Where are you going to put it? And yet, if you ride around Bloomington, West Bloomington even, there are open spaces. Is there really no space that one can find in West Bloomington for a large chain store?
Well, it depends upon what your definition of large chain store is. You know, if you're looking for more of an Aldi or a Save-A-Lot, that's going to be able to be accommodated on a site that's about 2 acres, because they would need a building that's 20,000 roughly square feet or less, plus the parking to equivalently match that. But if you're talking about maybe a more larger scale Kroger or definitely a Walmart or a Jewel, you're going to need a building on the size of 60,000 to 70,000 square feet and a much larger parking lot to match that. So there are a few sites on the west side that could potentially accommodate a smaller scale grocery store, but they're not necessarily clear sites or shovel ready. And they are maybe currently used by a different type of user, and so that would require that user to potentially relocate and have a complete redevelopment of that site or a portion of it. And that would all be very expensive and potentially costly. And, you know, the city staff have had conversations with some of the owners of those different properties over the years about, you know, the city's willingness to help that redevelopment happen.
Are you saying that it's virtually impossible then for the people of the West Side to get something they've been asking for decades?
I would not say that it's impossible, but it would be difficult. But I think that, you know, the city fully understands the need and hears the residents and is working to try to solve the problem in a cost-effective manner.
When was the last time you did have a conversation with, say, Kroger or Schnucks?
I'm in frequent conversations with either the direct retailers, the Krogers, the Aldis of the world, or their designated real estate and marketing team that they contract with, and explaining to them the market potential that's out there. And many of them realize it and have traveled our market and have seen that there is potential demand. But then again, it gets back to available site that's large enough for the type of development that they want to put together. Another issue that comes along with helping these retailers be successful is this concept of co-tenancy. They often like to locate in shopping centers or in close proximity to other supportive retailers. So a grocery store of a limited service that's targeting more of a lower income market often likes to locate in a strip mall that is also occupied by a dollar store or other complementary services that helps bring traffic to the grocery store, and everyone kind of feeds off of each other. So in the event that a space like that becomes available in an existing shopping center, I'll definitely be on the phone with those retailers to let them know about that. I would say, you know, the grocery industry is a very competitive and very tough industry with very slim margins. And at this very point in time in 2016, 2017, 2018 is a very difficult time to be in the grocery business due to a recent deflation that all grocers have encountered. All those grocers are able to buy their products less expensively and are thankfully passing those savings along to their customers. But at the same time, that really hits at their bottom line as well. So that has created potentially a difficult environment. But I think that we're starting to see that deflationary cycle is starting to ease.
Kroger, a year or so ago, said they wanted to move their College Avenue store, yet they wanted to move it just a few yards away from where it is now. Would that not have been a time for the city to step in and say, why can't you do something on the west side, or why can't you do more with your Main Street store?
Right. Well, of course, that would be a great time to have that conversation, and that conversation definitely was had, because I wouldn't be doing my job as the City of Bloomington's Economic Development Coordinator if I didn't impress upon the third largest grocer in the world the missed potential for opportunity for them throughout the city. So I'm very pleased that the City Council partnered with Kroger to assist them with the development of the proposed Kroger Marketplace at College and Hershey. That will is proposed to be their flagship store for this community, and I think it's a positive sign that they would choose to invest in Bloomington, and would be hopeful that they would continue to invest and upgrade their stores elsewhere throughout the city.
But that's on hold now, that project.
Right. As I mentioned, the deflationary cycle that has caught all grocers has also affected Kroger, and they have are passing along the lower prices to their customers and reinvesting their capital in different ways rather than opening new stores. They had a plan to open at least 300 new stores across the country, and that was going to unfold over the next couple of years. They have rolled that plan back now more to open potentially 50 stores across the country over the next couple of years.
Do you have some sort of timetable that you're looking at? What can you say to the people of West Bloomington who have been asking for years for a supermarket to come in there? Can you say maybe in 2 years, maybe in 3 years, maybe in 5 years?
Well, if I had a project in my back pocket, I'd love to have that going right away. But again, the city has to be careful that it doesn't go out and try to make a market that isn't necessarily there and get overzealous in offering incentives. Case in point is the city of Peoria created a TIF district and acquired a bunch of homes and demolished them in order to create a Cub Foods grocery store. I believe it's on Knoxville Avenue. And unfortunately, that store didn't quite work out, and it closed after only being open for a few years. And so now they have a very large vacant strip mall and a large vacant grocery store. So it's all going to be dependent upon finding that right operator, that right partner, and then I'm sure that the city would be willing to step up and help with a project if needed.
Austin Grammer is the Economic Development Coordinator for the City of Bloomington. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
I'm Judy Valente.
West Bloomington is the most serious example of a food desert in the Twin Cities, but the USDA map of food deserts also shows some neighborhoods in North Normal are not close to a supermarket. Grammer says the difference is those neighborhoods are in more affluent areas where residents generally have ready access to cars they can use to get to a grocery store. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping investors plan for the future and stay on track for retirement and college savings based on their unique situations and goals. Details at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
I'm Mike McCurdy. The environment, including climate change and maintaining and expanding health care coverage, were among the top issues for attendees at GLT's candidate forum Tuesday evening. The primary election forum at the Normal Theater featured five Democrats looking to unseat 13th District Republican Congressman Rodney Davis. It included Jonathan Ebel, David Gill, Eric Jones, Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan, and Angel Sides. GLT correspondent Colleen Reynolds talked with some in the crowd watching the forum. They shared with her the issues that matter to them as they scrutinized their choices among the five candidates.
I'm pretty concerned about the Russia issue, and I would like to know that my representative is also concerned about it. I'm concerned about environmental issues. I'm not necessarily against every single piece of the new tax plan, but I am worried that it's going to shift wealth from the less wealthy to the more wealthy. I'm pretty concerned about the Affordable Care Act and don't want to see that destroyed. It's already being dismantled by the recent votes.
I'm interested in all the issues. But I'd like to see if there's a candidate who's willing to compromise. I don't think any of them are going to be. But I really think we need to get rid of the partisanship. That's wrecking our country right now.
What issues in particular are important to you as a college student?
Tuition is very important, the cost of tuition. Health care is important because the provision in the Obamacare that if when you turn 26 you get off your health care, but it's highly possible that it might get repealed. Poverty and in the environment are also very important to me as a liberal and a person.
I think it's important to continue to have health care. I think the Obamacare was a great thing and helped a lot of people. I think it's important to get more women in because I think that'll give us a more balanced view as far as the outlook of the country and the different views that a female would bring than a male. So those are important things to me.
As you listen, what issues are important to you?
For me, it's environmental issues. That's one that's on my mind. I think the other thing is, since this is for U.S. Congress, there's also the immigration issue, and all of those things surrounding the immigration are very important to me.
Yes, definitely women's rights. That would be what I'm here to hear about, and I would also echo what he says. But yeah, I think we're kind of going in the wrong direction.
Did you hear a winner?
No. I saw a loser or two.
Did they cover the issues that you wanted to hear?
Yeah. I don't think they're ready to compromise, but I'm still hopeful.
Did you want to indicate who maybe you thought were the front runners in listening to what you heard?
Eric Jones and Betsy Dirksen-Lodigan impressed me. But I'll change my mind later.
What did you think about what you heard there?
They all spoke from their hearts, and I thought all of them represent themselves well. We did get to immigration, we did get to the environment, and I think that there were good points made. I think it's going to be a hard choice, but I think this helped clear it up a bit and introduced me to new people that I didn't know about.
I feel great encouragement that people of that quality are here debating against each other with respect and with agreeing on some things and not always agreeing, but always treating each other, with the highest regard and pushing forward the things that matter to me.
Was there a single front runner or a couple of front runners?
Yes, I would have to say that I thought Jonathan probably is my front runner. after listening to all. Although, as John just said here, it was I have a lot of thinking to do about several of them. I'm going to do some research now.
In the last, in 2012, I did vote for Mr. Gill, and so I have been following him. But Jonathan Ebel really came forward tonight for me in terms of his response. He also he became really a human to me as well in terms of some of his, how he presented himself, and he speaks well. So did Mr. Jones. Both of them really came forward and were well-rounded in their answers and what they projected in the room, and I'm glad I was here in person as well.
There was some humor here tonight, right?
Lots of humor. Wasn't it refreshing? And agreement when someone would say something, someone else at the table would nod yes, instead of it being so, you know, fractured and so hostile, and so that was refreshing.
They all talked about very progressive issues, and I think Illinois 13 with any Democrat will be in good shape.
GLT's Colleen Reynolds with audience members at the 13th District Democratic Congressional Primary Forum. Those weighing in include Susan Coulter, Gary Klass, Alyssa York, Kim Romsberger, and John Stark and Lori Adams. You can hear the entire forum featuring Jonathan Ebel, David Gill, Eric Jones, Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan, and candidate Angel Sides at our website, WGLT.org. You're listening to Sound Ideas. Illinois Wesleyan University is dramatically increasing financial awards for McLean County High School graduates who choose IWU in Bloomington. University President Eric Jensen has announced a program to offer at least $27,000 a year in assistance for enrollees from the local area, and often more. This will help McLean County students to the tune of about $3,500 above the average award. GLT's Charlie Schlenker spoke with Jensen at the Shirk Center after the announcement Wednesday night. He says IWU wants to help the university be a special place through the initiative, but there's also value to the community from focusing on local enrollment.
Well, I think it's there's at least two reasons that come to mind immediately. One is that we're a part of this community and we want to express our commitment to Bloomington Normal. It's a special place. It's a kind of a tight-knit community. You know, we've talked before, I'm still relatively new here, but it's striking to an outsider how tight-knit it is. And it's a community that's very well educated. I think the best educated metropolitan area in Illinois. So we've got a very strong base from which to draw. Families that value education, that have smart, well-educated high school graduates coming out. From our point of view, also, we're trying to build these interactive experiences for students where they have some ownership over their education. Signature experiences, signature work, whatever you'd like to call that, and that's going to involve interactions with people in the community. And what better way to get those things rolling in a big way than to have students who already have some familiarity with what's happening in the community?
What advantage does that get for, say, someone who goes into an internship if they are local as opposed to in a different community?
Well, first off, it's more than an internship. It's really a sort of a high-content, faculty-mentored kind of experience that involves also collaboration with outsiders in the way that an internship might. And I think part of that is identifying the thing that lights you up. You know, what is it that you know about a place that you realize, well, I wish that were different, or I wish I could work on that issue, or I wish, you know, in some way that I could have a hand in that. And I think that if you have people who've grown up in town, people who've got some familiarity with these things, that they're in some ways more educated consumers of what those things might be. They may have been exposed to them in community service work they did in high school or in some other venue.
So what are a couple of examples of how that sort of background could make someone more effective in the interactions with faculty or in an internship or in a project out in the community?
Well, I think the interactions with faculty, we're going to count on our high-quality students to be, you know, sort of part of that no matter where they come from. But if you think about maybe somebody who had some exposure to I don't know, they went to the YMCA as kids, or the YWCA as kids, and the Y was interested in expanding a particular service, and the question would be, my example would be economics, because I'm an economist. I'll pick something I'm familiar with. The Y wanted to know what the sort of market, what the recoverable fees might be for a particular program that they want to start to do some outreach into the community. Well, you know, we'd have students who were able to do that, who maybe even knew the people involved at the YMCA, who could kind of slot right in with a level of trust and familiarity that somebody who came from outside wouldn't necessarily have.
Many internships for someone who's not in their home community require extra expense. Does this make it easier for them to accept certain kinds of workplace experiences?
It could. Part of what we want to do is be able to help fund those kinds of extra expenses as they come up. As we develop these signature experiences, we want to be able to support our faculty and our students in doing things that have merit on their own. And if some financial concern is a stumbling block, we'd like to find ways around that. So hopefully that's not a huge concern. We're not often talking about extra living expenses. I mean, I suppose students could live at home while they're doing the internship. I'm not sure if that's the alternative that many would pursue.
We're talking current enrollment that is local is about 7%. This could bump it up from 25 to 35 kids to up to 45 kids per cohort, you're saying. That doesn't seem like a big number, but why is that a really meaningful number to you?
Well, we're small. What we do is very personal. In fact, we're proud of the fact that what we do isn't really scalable. We couldn't do what we do on a really large scale. So if you think about an enrollment, pick a round number like 2,000. If we had 10% of our students from McLean County, if we had that 50 a year, and I think it's probably initially going to be lower than that, a number like that. But if we had that number, that's a significant share of the students that are enrolled here who are local. We get about 10 a year from New Orleans, and so we're going to have 40 students who are from New Orleans. What a nice thing to be able to have the locals bring the New Orleans kids home for dinner, and maybe the New Orleans kids bring the locals down there at let's not say Mardi Gras, they'd miss class, but you know, get a little exchange program going.
Is there a benefit to the community over a generational course of a life spent starting with an Illinois Wesleyan University education?
I know a large number of people in town who are Illinois Wesleyan alums. They seek me out because of my job. Everybody is very friendly and welcoming, and the number of these people who have made enormous differences in town is remarkable. Let's start with somebody like Ed Rust and the impact of State Farm on the community. The number of people at State Farm who are Illinois Wesleyan grads as part of their careers is enormous. And so I think we've through the years had a deeply formative impact on this community. A huge number of the key contributors to this community are Illinois Wesleyan grads, maybe a disproportionate number. I don't know enough of the community to say that for sure. But I think the notion that we can continue to contribute to that moving forward is important.
What is the tendency of homegrown graduates to stay in a home community? Or what is the tendency of any graduate anywhere to stay in the community that they graduate from?
What we know historically is that if you're at a place at the present time, you're more likely to have had some experience prior, including potentially going to school or growing up there or something like that. We're a mobile country. You know, people move in the U.S. from place to place. If anything, I would guess that trend is going to accelerate. You know, you hear these statistics that students are going to do, that graduate in the next few years are going to have not just different jobs, but seven or eight different careers over their lifetimes. If those careers were separated geographically, I wouldn't be surprised. So I'm not going to speculate on the future, but it's a fair guess, I would say, that if somebody were educated here, they'd be more likely to stay than if they weren't.
IWU President Eric Jensen speaking with GLT's Charlie Schlenker. Jensen says the university will pay for the awards through a four-year, $2 million fundraising campaign. Local support will bring total tuition down to about $20,000. Jensen says that's only about $4,000 more a year than Illinois State University tuition. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for GLT comes from The Music Shop, helping student musicians of all skill levels sound their best by partnering with school band and orchestra programs throughout Central Illinois. Instrument rentals, sales, maintenance, and repair. Details at themusicshop.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The seven-piece Latin fusion band, the Brazilianaires, add 50-plus pieces to their sound when they merge with the Peoria Symphony Orchestra for their annual romance concert this weekend. The Central Illinois-born and now Nashville-based group will play orchestrated originals with the symphony Saturday in the Peoria Civic Center Theater. Brazilianaires guitarist Rico Johnson and vocalist Dove Benoit stopped by the GLT studios to talk with John Norton about this special Valentine's mood show.
Winter seems the time to go, leaving footprints in the snow.
So the song you're hearing is from the Brazilianaires. It's called Blue October. And this is a song that's going to be orchestrated in the Peoria Civic Center Theater here on the 10th. So Peoria Symphony contacted you, right?
That's correct, yeah. George DeLuto, the maestro, conductor. We actually did a concert a couple of years back with Charles Yang, who's this great violinist that came to play with the symphony. And we were doing an outdoor concert on the riverfront of Peoria. Charles came up and actually sat in and played a few songs with us. So after that, George DeLuto came right up to the stage and said, "Hey, have you ever orchestrated your music?" And at the time we said no, but that'd be interesting. And then a few months later, he actually called us and said, "We'd love to have you as part of our symphonic season. Can you make it happen?"
What was your initial reaction when he contacted you and said, "I want to do this. This will be a cool blending of music"?
Total awe. I mean, just to be asked to do it is just an amazing thing. And, you know, we just jumped on the opportunity because you can't say no to that sort of thing. And it's been a real challenge, but a really good challenge. And we're really excited about it.
So it's all your original music that they're orchestrating?
Yeah, that's correct.
That's a really cool thing.
Mm-hmm.
Man, how many pieces are going to be in the band?
Over 50 plus instruments. And we'll use our band. Our band will be up front, which is we have a seven-piece band, Dove and I front, and we have five musicians in the Brazilianaires.
Is that kind of intimidating? I mean, it's really different.
Yeah, it is. It's intimidating, but it's really exhilarating as well. To be able to hear these pieces that we've created become these symphonic masterpieces is just going to take to a whole new level, you know, just this totally different take on our music. And it's still there. The music of the Brazilianaires is still very much apparent in the symphonic music.
Well, that's a question. What does orchestrating your music, which is already has seven pieces, that's a decent-sized band in a club, but now you're getting 50 on top of that. What does that add? How does that change? How does that make your music bring out different elements of your music or songs?
Well, I think the key is keeping the Latin groove that we have, because that's kind of the hot sauce of our band. And the two orchestrators that have helped us do that, they've made sure that has happened. But it's almost like taking our music from, I've used this analogy, from two-dimensional to three-dimensional. Some songs, obviously, for the radio, our songs are usually about 3 or 4 minutes long. Now they're being stretched 6, 7 minutes with beautiful, lush intros, interludes in the middle, just amazing things.
Have you rehearsed yet with the Peoria Symphony?
No, we have two rehearsals scheduled.
Okay.
The concertmaster, Marcia Henry Liebenau, who is actually playing the first half of our concert, she's doing a Bruch romantic symphony. She just seems really excited about it because it is a different type of music than they're used to playing. And she's actually going to play one of our songs with us. I think the symphony is excited from the take of Marcia. And I think it'll be different for them and fun.
To the bang, to the bone. Everything just starts since you've been gone. To the bang.
listening to GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton in the studio with Dove Enrico from the Brazilian Airs. Going to be playing with the Peoria Symphony Orchestra on the 10th. It's the annual romance concert. So when you're out playing, you kind of generalize it as Latin, but it's pop, it's kind of jazzy, it's kind of a bunch of different things. Are you doing sambas or bossas or... You know, cha-cha stuff. You're doing flamenco.
All of the
are
above.
You doing?
Yeah.
I mean, there's Brazilian rock too, and I mean, Latin can cover a lot of different
sure.
things.
Sure. Well, you know, John, when the band first started, we did primarily Brazilian rhythms, sambas, bossa novas, but we've kind of morphed into this Latin fusion band now, where we do boleros and we do cha-chas and we do actually some Spanish, kind of a Gypsy King flamenco type of feel. We still write bossa novas and sambas, but we've kind of again, morphed into other Latin rhythms. So.
Have you talked with Scott Hall up at Columbia College in Chicago? He's the one that's orchestrating this whole thing. Are you in constant communication with him on how this is all being fleshed out?
Yeah, he was here. Actually, we had a rehearsal last night. He came down for that rehearsal. And he, I don't know if you know much about Scott, but he is an incredible orchestrator. He actually orchestrated, the great pianist Ramsey Lewis orchestrated.
For Ravinia?
For mm-hmm. Ravinia.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I also, I'd be remiss if I didn't say, we're doing 10 selections, original songs that we've written, but 8 of those Scott is orchestrating, but 2 of those pieces are being orchestrated by a local guy here, the jazz director of Illinois State University, Tom Marco.
Tom Marco, mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Well, that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Well, let's play another one of your songs. I wish we could play something that's orchestrated, you know, some kind of, we can't, but I want to give our listeners a feel for, that haven't heard the Brazilianers. God, there's hardly any anymore in Bloomington Normal, right? Everybody knows who you guys. So let's play Venetian Blinds right now. Let's give this just a little bit of a twist, okay?
Great.
Blinds reveal such a scrumptious sight, a specimen as fine as good old moon.
So Mark was a part of it too. I did not know that.
Oh. Well, he actually co-wrote Blue October with Wayne.
Yeah, Rico.
And so Rico, yeah, sorry. So, you know, he really was wanting to orchestrate that one specifically, and then we decided to do another song that we love off of the CD called The Encounter, and he orchestrated that as well. And actually we were a little concerned about, you know, how is that going to blend with one orchestrator doing a bunch and then having somebody else? But it's perfect. It's beautiful.
Well, I saw the video on Facebook of you guys playing with Charles Yang, right? And you admitted you were a little dubious about the connection of Charles with you guys together, but it's really cool what I saw on there. And that, what's that slow part? There's just one, it's only a 6-minute promotional video, right? But this is really slow piece in there. Do you remember what song that was? Because it is just beautiful. Let me play just a little piece of that right now. Okay.
It may have been Hotel California.
Was that part of Hotel California? Mm-hmm. Because that's there as well. Oh, I see. Oh, my God. I wish I would have seen that. That is beautiful.
Yeah, that was a really fun night, actually.
Because he was playing really slow, and then he really started picking it up later.
Yeah.
By the way, you're listening to GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton in the studio with Dove and Rico from the Brazilian Airs. What are you doing in Nashville?
We're pursuing our music.
You're going where the music is,
yeah.
It sounds
right,
like.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
You're making a go of it.
Absolutely, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, we're connecting with some songwriters down there. The industry's all there, you know, the publicists, the agents, the everything. So we're making those connections now. We've just been down there a few months. Our fan base is still up here in the Midwest, but we want to create this thing in Nashville and play out of Nashville.
How long have you been in Nashville now?
Since last September.
What are you finding out about yourselves or the band?
Well,
I guess that's what I mean. What are you finding out about the band? Do you got what it takes?
Yeah, I'll tell you what I think.
Yeah.
I really believe that our sound is unique. Even in Nashville, like there's a club that I went to last Monday night in Nashville that has a killer Afro-Cuban Latin band. You know, there's really amazing jazz players, obviously great songwriters there. But I think the fusion that we do, this fusion of Latin grooves with jazz and pop, I'm just not seeing many groups like what we're doing. So
You know, I'm surprised. There's a kind of a happening jazz scene in Nashville, which you think country and probably even indie rock now, but I mean, do you guys play the Bluebird down there at all?
No, we haven't yet.
That's a goal. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think a lot of people just think, oh, it's country western in Nashville. And that's really, I think, increasingly becoming not true. There's a lot of different musical genres, and any given night you can go out and see a variety of talent. And, you know, we're just excited to be there. And as Rico says, our music is different. It's people are always asking us, how do you describe it? And we kind of take pause and say, well, you know, it's this fusion. But really, we always just encourage people to go on Spotify or go on iTunes or Pandora or YouTube and just check us out, because really the only way to know the Brazilianaires is to see or hear the Brazilianaires.
And the Brazilianaires play with the Peoria Symphony Orchestra Saturday evening. They talked with GLT's John Norton. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, with stories and interviews today from Judy Valente, Colleen Reynolds, John Norton, and Charlie Schlenker. Find the full show podcast and individual stories and interviews at WGLT.org. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at Facebook.com/WGLTFM. You can even leave a message about Sound Ideas at 309-438-WGLT. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.